thanks to Misoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Misoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Misoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Misoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We'll talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives. But don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest this week is Yomi Adegoke, an award-winning journalist and co-author of the groundbreaking book, Slay in Your Lane.
We really sit there and we're like, oh, you know, everybody's beautiful in their own way, which, yeah, you know, I agree with to some point. But I also believe that even if they're not, so what?
Known as the Black Girl Bible, Slay in Your Lane is now a phenomenal brand in its own right, with a sequel, a podcast, and more in the pipeline. Yomi also writes for The Guardian and The Independent about feminism, popular culture, and race. We covered a lot of those juicy subjects in our conversation, as well as beauty standards, class, and what it feels like to shave your head. So, here we go. Let's start with your moment number one. So these are the moments that made you, chosen by you. I loved your list. As soon as I saw them, I thought, I know exactly how good this is going to be.
Yay!
Yeah, I know, I loved it. You can tell you're a journalist. You know what's going to be a good story. So
I've got the angle.
You've got the angles. Number one is the day you decided you're going to be happy with how you look no matter what.
Yes.
Tell me about that day.
I remember it very well. When was it? I didn't particularly think I was that attractive growing up. I wouldn't say that I felt that I was like monstrously ugly, but I was very keenly aware of like a prevalent beauty standard that I knew very much I didn't fit into. So it was interesting because obviously like when I was growing up and stuff, you have all these like relatives and like, you know, just random older people who'd always sort of say that like, oh, you're really gorgeous, you're gonna grow up to be really pretty. And I was kind of just like, but how, when prettiness looks like this and I'm not like that? So things like, you know, because there are standards within each community, right? So in the Black community, like obviously you've got the overall prevailing standard generally, which, you know, at that time growing up in Britain was very much like white, you know, slim, you know, fair hair, blue eyes, small nose, you know, whatever size lips, certainly not the lips that like are now being popularized and, you know, praising the mainstream. But then within the Black community, intra-communally, we have our own beauty standards. So that wasn't necessarily a thing. It definitely wasn't, you know, considered attractive to be massively skinny, for instance, which I was. Thickness is definitely like a concept that is, you know, has always consistently been praised within the Black community as a beauty standard. It's definitely trickled into the mainstream via the Kardashians and Jenners, who obviously, you know, take a lot of their sort of cues on beauty standards. You know, I call it a Mr. Potato Head approach to beauty, where they just kind of pick the bits like of certain cultures and certain looks, right? Lips, yeah. But they're like, yeah, skip the nose, take the lips, take the bum, take the hips, right? So in the Black community, like being lighter skinned, but not whiter skinned, but just like actually like, you know, caramel colored, then having like a body, like, you know, you'd hear rappers talking about like the various inches, like 34, 22, like, you know, 64, whatever. It was kind of like, you know, Jessica, real Jessica Rabbit shape. And then of course, like having like a particular type of hair, which then again, wasn't bone straight, but like looser curls that I didn't have. I guess after several years of being like, oh, my nose is like this and I'm never gonna look like that, I really do just remember just literally waking up one day and being like, you know what, this probably isn't going to change unless I pay for it to, and I'm never going to do that. And then just really understanding that like beauty, like, wasn't even necessarily in the eye of the beholder, but also just wasn't something that I decided mattered to me very much anymore, because it's just literally one of the few things in my life I was never in control of. And I feel like it's no moral indicator of who you are as a person. You know, we really sit there and we're like, oh, you know, everybody's beautiful in their own way, which, yeah, you know, I agree with to some point. But I also believe that even if they're not, so what? And that was kind of my thought process at 15. I was just like, even if I'm not, so what? Like, are there loads of other things about me that, like, you know, it sounds very like, you know, primary school, Disney, like, oh, you've got to love yourself. But honestly, I was like, even if, you know, beauty isn't in the eye of the beholder, and, you know, it's this set thing that everybody kind of adheres to, which isn't true. At the end of the day, like, I don't want to sit here and be like, well, I'm beautiful to somebody, because that's still contingent on the taste of someone else. I was just like, I just really, I like who I am as a person and what I'm doing. And I know I have, like, good intentions, and I know that I'm clever. So I just was like, oh, like, piss off, basically. I was just like, I genuinely, do you know what I mean? I just don't care anymore. So that's the story.
Yeah, that's such a good story. And when you put it down like that, it's so true. And we ascribe so much to that, and how
people so heavily
the halo effect of, like, when someone's yes. good looking, when in fact they can be a complete arse. And like you said, it's just luck.
Often are.
Yeah, often they haven't are. Done anything to be that good looking except for be born. Not achieved
it. Exactly. Yeah. Except for be born. And I think that's the thing, is who really cares, because we're all going to get really old and saggy anyway. So, you know, true. We have to learn to, do you know what I mean? Like, true. Live with. Yeah, like,
and also you've got to learn to just, like, not be so obsessed with your looks, because that's gonna go, and you're gonna have to do something different when you get older, right? When no one's looking at you thank anymore you. You're gonna have to find some new things to interest people. Yeah, I think absolutely. What you said, if you could, like, bottle it and give that to young women, it would be amazing, because it's basically think about something else, because this way lies madness, right? Because you can't you can control it only up to a certain point
for sure,
and otherwise you just go crazy trying absolutely. To be perfect and worrying about it. Yeah,
absolutely. And that realization that you just won't be everybody's type.
Totally. And but I think for you to get to that point at 15, right, you must have been quite confident. What was happening? Like, you grew up in a family in Croydon, Nigerian yes, family. Nigerian. Like, yeah. was there a kind of sense that, like, were they building you up and getting you to the point where you felt like that?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, it's always been interesting, because my mum is, like, very skinned and my dad is quite dark. And I think a lot of people I know that have internalized, like, colorism, so, like, the, you know, the idea that, like, you know, you're being treated worse or better depending on your skin tone and how close it is to, like, whiteness, essentially, and how light-skinned you are. My mom was very fair, but my mom had, you know, three, like, pretty much dark-skinned children, and she never, I know of some people who've said that, you know, their moms or, like, their parents would kind of, like, internalize, like, being light-skinned and kind of project, like, certain ideas onto their kids. But my mum, being a light-skinned woman, like, she didn't at all. Like, she was married to a dark-skinned man. When we used to go, like, on holiday and, like, you know, I'd get darker, I have no recollection of my mum being, like, stay out the sun. But I have loads right. of friends that say that their parents, you know, said things like that. And I guess when I'd come home and be like, wow, my nose, like, I mean, I can't, I mean, obviously my mum would say the typical, like, oh, you know, my all my kids are beautiful or whatever. But then also, I think, like, my dad as well, that there was just, you know, Nigerians in particular, there's a real education focus. So they were right. just like, there's bigger fish to fry, girl. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're, yeah. you know, you're a very intelligent girl. Like, go and, like, you know, worry about, like, getting those grades.
Well, you were clearly very smart and a very intelligent young woman who went on to go to the University of Warwick, which is an excellent university.
Oh, thank
and I
you.
Say that because I went there.
Yeah. Next, bubble.
I mean, I probably went there a lot earlier than you.
And yet, but I bet nothing had changed.
So I had a great time at Warwick, but I was totally the demographic that you, I know, have written about, like, that it was the majority, right? You were, like, felt right. extremely out of place.
Absolutely, for sure.
Tell me about it.
God, it was a game changer, and I think one of the biggest game changers for me in terms of Warwick wasn't even, I mean, racially, I was obviously one of the few black students. it wasn't even just in terms of race, though. It was like in terms of like the class, like implications, and like right. going there from a state school was just absolutely like mind-boggling and blowing, because I'd never been around, like, for lack of better phrase, like so many posh people. Like it was, right. I always joke that, you know, I'd left Croydon and like the pigeons had changed to swans, because obviously we had swans on Warwick campus, and I was just like, what, yeah. where am I? Like it was just like, it was so different. It was a real culture shock, but more, I'd say from a, I mean, you like, how do I put it? Like there were loads of Nigerian students, funny enough, but these were Nigerian students that like would also, like they used to call us like the, you know, Black British working class kids, brap brap kids, because again, they were super rich. I went to uni right. with someone whose granddad was on the Naira, like his face was right. on the currency of Nigeria. So I was like, literally, like I was going to uni with, like, you know, I'm like, oh, here are all these Black Nigerian kids. And it's like, well, A, they don't consider me Nigerian because I'm British and I don't speak any Nigerian dialect or language. And B, I'm not rich and I'm not privately educated. And even though they're Nigerian, I mean, to be able to be Nigerian and to get into an institution like Warwick, most of the time it's because you've gone to international school or private school, and you're yeah. richer than the bloody white kids that go there. Like they are like oil magnate rich. Obviously I knew there were like super rich Nigerian people, just like they're super rich people anywhere, but like it was just how even they, because I think class as a real kind of distinction is often like, you know, ignored in like the conversations around intersectionality. But going to Warwick, like I'd be lying if I pretended that it was just all these like white rich kids playing lacrosse, because the, you know, the international students were like as well off and as classist and as kind of exclusionary. So we just had our little bandy yeah. together in our little like Black like South London collective.
So moment two is about Warwick, which yeah. is you're the first race difference and inclusive society lecture that you ever went to.
Yes.
This was a moment for you. What happened?
Wow. So I remember, again, I remember this clear as day. I obviously had come to Warwick from Croydon. Croydon is a very, very ethnically diverse borough. I think it has the highest Caribbean population in the country. Right. It's very diverse. And I obviously knew what racism was and knew about, like, in my brain, it was very much like, you are racist because, you know, you attack a minority for minding their business, or like, you know, I had a really kind of like dictionary, like children's dictionary definition of what racism was. And then I had, God, I think I'd taken, maybe this was just before I took my year out of uni or after, I can't remember. But I remember I had the option to take a course that was off of my, you know, like outside of law, which I hated. Right. But this guy, it was, you know, it was a course about basically race difference and the inclusive society, did what it said on the tin. I remember coming into the lecture and, you know, I was really looking forward to it because it was the first time, I guess, I'd had to study race as a, like racism as a concept. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, like, you know, at school we learn about the slave trade and it's like, oh, the slave trade happened and that was racism. And that's how we learn, that's how we conceive of what racism is.
Right.
So I was like, this is going to be fascinating. And I went in and I literally came out a completely different person. Like, it was absolutely one of the most intense experiences of my life, because
wow.
he just said so many different things that had never crossed my mind that I was like gobsmacked. Like I remember he was telling us that, like, statistically, you know, Black people are more likely to, and this still is the case, are more likely to enter mental health services via like through police or through sectioning. And when they do get into like their mental health like services, they are more likely to be given older medication, like older, more strong, like medication, like for their mental health. And I remember, like, I remember thinking, but how comes that's allowed? And I'm pretty sure someone put their hand up and kind of was like, okay, thanks for the, like, okay, thanks for the tidbit and that horrendous kind of like nugget of information. But what's the story behind the story? Like, why? Like, what's the reason?
Right.
And he's like, the reason is racism. And we are just like, what? And he just was telling us all these stats and it was crazy. And I think, to be honest, that probably would have been how a couple of people felt reading Stay in Your Lane, where you're reading it and you keep reading thinking like, surely there is a reasoning behind this that goes beyond like just prejudice, because this would have, you know, where is the government intervention? If we know this is happening, how comes it's allowed to happen? And he was very much just like, well, because society is inherently racist. I was like,
wow.
Absolutely wow. Gobsmacked. He was talking about how, you know, it's obviously such a perception-based thing, and the fact that like it's looking at somebody and being like, okay, you are this. Whereas like, you know, there are people, someone like Meghan Markle is, inverted commas, as mixed-raced as someone like Barack Obama. Like, Meghan Markle, because of, like, how she's treated in the British press, like, she's very much racialized as a black woman. But prior, when she was on Suits, a lot of people didn't even realize that she had black heritage. A lot of people thought she was Latina or she was something else. Whereas Barack Obama, like, he very visibly, like, outside of any context, looks like a black man, inverted commas.
Yeah.
So it was, like, the first time that, like, you know, we were having this conversation about perception and, like, how it is just such a perception-based thing, and, you know, talking about white passing people, and it was just crazy. And I came out of it, and I remember kind of, like, you know, with the town choir bell, like, just gathering the, like, seven black people and being like, I literally remember I was on my way, like, to, I can't remember, I think we're going, like, to the supermarket, and I was like, gathering everybody around, like, you know, I don't know if there was still the Tesco around the back when you were there, but we were on our way to the Tesco, and I remember, yes. Like, yeah, I literally was like, you will never guess what I just heard. And they were like, what? And I was like, oh my, and I was just relaying all these stats to them, and they were just like, what? And it was crazy, because we all knew what racism was, but it wasn't like today. Like, it wasn't like, this predates the whole kind of Tumblr revolution of like racialized discourse being condensed into, like, you know, blogs and tweets and threads. This was just like, you had to go to uni or you had to buy the
Then what did you do with that? Like, did you then think, I want to make a difference, which then led you to write the book? It did?
Not directly to write the book, but it definitely, because that was literally, gosh, like a conversation that had happened with my best friend, like years later, funnily enough. But like, this was the first time that I really was like, that's why I remembered, actually, this took place before I left uni, because I was like, I remember that then led me to being like, I want to like write more. I don't know, I hadn't really thought of it as a systemic and like institutional and endemic like plague. I'd really just thought like of racism in this kind of like really basic comic strip, like this person from the Ku Klux Klan is like planning to kill this black person, like that it wasn't, you know what I
mean? So you didn't appreciate until that point like quite how fully it was just infusing everything.
Absolutely,
because I had life.
Absolutely. I'd had like, I didn't realize how much for so many people our like kind of like, I don't know, like our lives had been written by this thing. Like,
so this moment when you went to that lecture, that kind of flipped a switch in your brain where you're like, there is racism.
Yeah, and it's real. Yeah.
And it's real. And it started you writing more. But then we come on to moment three, which is you deciding to leave university.
Yes.
What happened?
So I decided to leave university, I shit you not, because of a CAPTCHA. Is that how you pronounce it? You know, you get those things on the, when you're trying to access like a website, and then they're like, can you prove you're not a robot by typing in like this really weird swirly writing, and it will say something stupid. Like,
oh yeah.
Corn dog, and you've got to then write it out. So I literally like, genuinely, I'm not even joking when I say that. The thing that tipped me over the edge was a CAPTCHA, because I hope that's how it's pronounced, but I was like having the worst time in my second year of university. It was so hard. I hated law. Mm-hmm. And again, obviously, I was really homesick. Croydon could not be more, to be fair, Croydon's not that different from Coventry, but it couldn't have been that different, more different from Warwick University. Mm. I was massively homesick. And then obviously, a massive cultural shock. I was like, just generally from all sides, just over it. And then I was like, oh, I feel really bad. And I can't like leave my bed. And I'm just watching American Dad. Like, I think at that point, they were like, 14, no, they've got, I feel like they had to be like 20 series or something, because I was just watching it like back to back, and I was like, what is this? Like, what is wrong with me? Why am I not leaving my bed? And then I was like, is this depression? I was like googling like symptoms, and was like, is this depression? Is this the thing that they call depression that like I've never experienced? And you know, I just was like, how is this even happening? I've got nothing to be depressed about. And then I was like kind of self-diagnosed, and was like, shit, I actually think I'm depressed. And I contacted this was after like lots of like help from like brilliant friends. Like there's a one friend in particular who I'll never forget, like came around like all these bags of food and shopping. Her name's Ajwa. I'll never forget that day. Like Aww. It was just like such a vision. She just came Aww. With all these bags of like goodies and stuff and just like sat with me, and I didn't really know what was wrong, so it was really hard. And like eventually, like I spoke to somebody, I contacted somebody at uni. They put me in touch with a counselor. That counselor was amazing, and like had, you know, he worked with like people from African and Caribbean backgrounds before, and kind of had like, he made certain comments about like, you know, even just the conservatism of like African parents and not necessarily understanding like depression as an illness and seeing it more as a like, you know, spiritual attack. And right. even him just noting that, I felt so comfortable.
Right.
And then, but you know, I was still quite bad, and I will never forget, like, as I said, I was watching loads of like TV and just loads of like films on illegal sites. And I was trying to watch Shutter Island one day. And then I remember it was taking me like 4 days to watch it because the link was so bad. And I was like typing in for the like seventh time, I'd like refreshed it. I was like typing in like the capture each time and like trying to match it. And then right. one day the capture said, "This too shall pass." I was like, what? I genuinely was so perplexed because my dad used to tell me that story. You know that thing about this?
Yeah.
The king, and he's got the ring. And yeah. Right.
I've got a like, ring with that on.
You're
I
joking.
Love that story. No, I love that story.
I have an
story.
X with that tattoo. No and I way. Thought my... he was my like husband. Oh my God.
That's amazing. What? Do you yeah. know, it's so funny. I love that. Yeah, I love it. Love Crazy. It. I got my brother a necklace with it engraved on. Yeah, it's one of the best things ever.
I love that. I need a ring. That's even made me think.
Oh my God, I'm going to get you one.
Get me a ring that says that, because that's a great, it's just such a great story. And it's just like, you know, oh, okay, he gets this, you know.
Should we tell the story quickly?
Yeah, you tell the story, B. You should tell it.
Well, basically, really, really quickly, the story is... I mean, it's sort of credited to lots of different places, but it's like
yeah.
possibly an Old Testament, like folkloric story. But anyway, yeah. a king says to some man, "Find me a ring that makes a happy man sad and a sad man happy." Mm. And this guy goes around looking for this ring. He can't find it. And then some old sort of weird old man somewhere. I don't know.
Says There's always him, one new story.
Says to him, yeah, I'll show you what it is. And he writes on this ring in Hebrew, Gamze Yavor, which means "this too shall pass." And the guy looks at it and he goes, oh.
Yes.
And that's it.
I love it. Because you're never going to be happy forever, and you're like, in a moment it will pass, and you're never going to be like the pain and hardship of something's not always going to be there either, because just either way it will, you know, and you'll move on.
Whatever you do with that phrase, you choke up. Because you're like...
Literally, either way, it's sad.
Yeah, exactly. Or either way, it's uplifting.
Or no, either it's way, it's happy, sad. Right? It's so true.
It's just an amazing phrase. It's amazing.
I flipping love it. And it's like, my dad had told me that story so many times. And like, I just remember seeing it, like, you know, it's literally, it's like, obviously normally Capture is just chatting absolute shit. Like, you know, Halo brand or like toy tree. And it's just like, this actually said fully, "this too shall pass." And I was like, okay, like, I don't know what, this is burning bush, like level, like, you know, my real Sunday school like past, like really coming back with full like them. And I was just like, oh my God, my computer is talking to me. And I was like, this is so scary. My computer thinks that I should like be like, I needed to leave uni. But it was like, I've been thinking about it, and I saw that, and it literally took me over the edge. And I could have interpreted that as, you know, this isn't gonna last forever, so let me stay at uni. But I literally interpreted it as, this isn't gonna last forever, so let me leave, and let me like try and get my shit together and come back. And it was the best decision I ever made, because honestly, I do not think I'd be, because it's when I started like writing more. I started a blog, I started up like a magazine, like a publication.
Yeah.
I did some like internships, and if I hadn't done that, I honestly don't think I'd be where I am in terms of journalism.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to take a second to tell you about The Female Lead. In case you don't know, we're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So if you haven't already, please do subscribe. It will really help us to continue our work. Now, back to the show.
That is exactly what I was going to ask you, which is like, if you stayed and you finished your law degree, like, would we have had Slay in your lane?
Probably oh my gosh, not. I genuinely don't think so, because, you know, like, I probably would be a miserable lawyer waiting for, you know, a message in my cereal, like my, you know, do you know what I mean? Waiting for the O's of the Cheerios to line up to spell out something in like Morse code. Like, I don't know, but honestly, I don't think we would, because I really think that like me leaving uni was the best. It was the first time I really felt about like, I'm choosing something for me. And it wasn't easy to explain to my parents, because they didn't really necessarily understand why I was depressed. They did eventually, but you know, they also like they were concerned and everyone was a bit confused, and you know, but I'm glad I did it, because you know, it was the first time I really felt like I'd chosen something for myself and just been like, I can't do this, so I'm not going to do this.
And were you scared about what was going to happen to you?
I was terrified. I was just like, I'm gonna be unemployable. And it's like, it's that thing as well, because it's like, obviously our parents are so harsh in terms of like, I mean, as I said, mine were quite open-minded comparatively, but they really do want you to do finance and be a lawyer and be an engineer, and sometimes it just looks like, oh, because they're, you know, boring. And it's like, no, actually it's because they know, they know about like how difficult it is to like come up in this space, and they want us to have that financial security. They want us to be the best people that we can be, and not have to necessarily go through the same struggles that they did. So it really does come from a place of love.
And this brings us on, I think, to moment four, which is an acquaintance says to you that you could get paid to write, and it's called journalism.
Literally, it's like, oh my God, like, so it's so ridiculous, because my sister is a journalist, and like, she'd gone to, it's so crazy, and it just shows how self-centered I was as a teenager. And like, she was a journalist, and like, and yet still, I had never thought of, you know, journalism as a viable career choice. She graduated like during the recession, so I'd seen her struggle a lot, and I'd seen her have like a lot of issues in terms of like employability and like sort of being able to navigate that space. And I remember she told me about certain newsrooms I won't name, where she'd like bring in like McDonald's, because like she flipping loves like a cheeseburger, like, and loves McDonald's nuggets and chips and stuff. Who doesn't? Who bloody doesn't? And like, she'd bring it into the office, and she was just like, everybody would just stare at her like, oh my God, this is so uncouth. And she was just like, oh my gosh, like, what is going on? Where am I that people don't like chicken nuggets? I was just like, yeah, like, because there was a real, again, class thing, and she just felt really like out of sorts. And you know, and I guess the assumption is the more liberal paper is, the less likely that's going to happen. But I mean, having been at like pretty much like at least in every newsroom, I'm like, they're all just the same people, just like slightly different political, like, do you know what I mean? Like, they went to the same schools.
Totally. But also, like, even if they have, like, there's only a few places to work, so like, this, someone who's even really left wing is probably going to do a this bit on the Mail, because
and the thing is, right, most of them, like, this is the thing that's so crazy, it's like, most of them are like married or like know each other or friends, and like, you realize that once you get in this space, it's like, wow, like, okay, so this person went to school, that person, this one, it's like, it's, there's not as much difference as like social media like makes you think, like, so it was very, very, like, again, elitist as it still is now. So my sister was like, you know what, she really, really struggled, and I kind of saw that and just didn't think journalism was something that I would do, and was very much like, I really want a comfortable life. So it's like, I'm going to be a lawyer. Then I was like, God, that's not going to work. So then I, like, I guess as an outlet for like lots of feelings, I like started a blog. I'd like moan about everything, and just literally moan about any and everything, and then you know, it had some traction, and I will never forget that, like, this, God, it's so crazy how it can just be the most random person. There was literally this like really middle class white boy that, like, he literally was just like, you know what, like, you're actually really, really good at this, and like, you have a real kind of like knack for like storytelling. And he was like, I don't know if you've ever thought of like doing this professionally. And I was just like, what, me? And it's so crazy, because obviously I'd read op-eds. Obviously my sister was a journalist, but I was just like, wait, me just moaning in a, hey, I was just, and it's crazy, because obviously I'd seen it, but I was just like, me though, like, because I really felt like, obviously with, you know, the kind of names we've grown up in the British press that are super like established and stuff, I'm like, yeah, they can do it, but I'm literally just me, like, how am I gonna be like, and this is my opinion. This guy was like, you could do this in a magazine and be paid. And I was like, no, I could not. And he was like, yes, it is. It's called journalism. And I was like, but this is, and I was like, I know what you're saying, but journalism is what my sister does, which is like, my sister's serious. Like, she literally, like, you know, she's been on the front line of, like, you know, what's the word, documenting things like the COVID crisis in Nigeria, right. And like Boko Haram, and she's got some, like, you know, we've got a number for if she like goes missing and stuff. Like, she's a real journo. So like, right. I was like, and I was like, I understand that there's like polemics and op-eds, but I was like, you have to be a type of person to do that. And I was like, I'm not that person. And like, you have to be basically posh, old, white, and probably male.
Right.
And I was like, I can't. And he was just like, of course you can. He was like, you're really good. And that was the first time, honestly, it like even occurred to me I could do that. And he was just this random boy that I've never spoken to like since. Like, but yeah, I really owe him. His name's Tom. Like, cheers, Tom.
And so, thank you, Tom. And so then from that, you then started to like try and get paid for what you were basically giving out for free, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I deleted the blog.
So, okay, moment number five is May 2015. You have a phone call with your best friend, Elizabeth, who you had met at Warwick.
Who she I was one had of your met friends. At Warwick. She was my best friend at Warwick. And like, you know, she goes off to this big city and she's like, you know, she works in corporate space. She's at a bank. And I'm at this point, I think I've like managed to get to like, I think I'm at Channel 4 News at this point as working as an online producer.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, this is like, oh my gosh, like this is
not
a big
too
jump.
Shabby.
Yeah. Not, this is a big jump from the blog after that deletion. It was like, yeah, there are a couple internships in there and a couple other jobs. But then, yeah, like I managed to get to Channel 4 and I'm like, I'm an online producer at Channel 4 News, and you know, like, had an amazing boss called John who like really supported me, like you know, I mean, I think he knew and I knew that like I should probably be writing, but like he liked my ideas and was very supportive. And like you know, me and Elizabeth would just genuinely, like, on a daily basis pretty much just have these like phone calls where we just would sit there and again generally moan and like bitch about, like, you know, if it wasn't Warwick, well now this time it was like her where she was working, and you know, and this is the thing, mine wasn't like Channel 4 News specifically as the space, but just the industry. I was like, you know, Channel 4, all the places I've worked was actually probably like the most kind of like nurturing. I think my boss was really like cool there, but like just generally, like, the journalistic industry is not it's not necessarily the most easy to navigate as a young black woman. So I would just be like, oh god, it's really hard. And she was just like, yeah, you know, same. And like, we just moan about it all the time, and like in the toilets, like, of our respective offices. And like, the long and short of it is that, like, she basically one day on one of these just like, you know, everyday complaint like runs that we had, it part of like the itinerary today, that day in May, did I say March or May? I can't remember.
May.
I think it was May, right? So it was May 2015. Mm-hmm. She calls me, and like part of her the itinerary is like, oh, I've had this idea, by the way. And I was like, oh, what is it? And she was like, well, you know how you want to write a book? Because at this point I was like, yeah, I want to write a book one day. I was like, yeah. And she's like, yeah, so I've had this like idea of, like, you know, she'd been reading like Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg and Girl Boss by Sophia Amoruso, and was kind of just like, there isn't anything that like references what it's like to be black and like try to navigate the world, especially the world of work. So she was like, I think you should write like this book that kind of like, you know, helps like, you know, black women in Britain like navigate, you know, the workspace and the workplace. And yeah, she was like, I think you'd be great at it because you're a writer. And I was like, as soon as she started talking, I literally like had like another screen up, like Googling, like, this must already exist. I was like, surely someone else has done this. And like, I couldn't find anything. And I was like, whoa, this is actually a brilliant idea. And then I was kind of like to her, like, okay. Again, I always say, like, I had this, that's so Raven, like, flash forward, where I kind of saw this world where, like, I'd given me the book idea and like it done really well. And like, she's from the audience, like, hey. And like, I've just got this whole thing built off like her idea. So I was like, I definitely think we should do this together, because not only is she like a brilliant marketing mind, but like, she's a great writer as well. So I was like, we should do it together. And then that's literally like genuinely how it happened. Like, we decided to, you know, bandy together and do Slay in Your Lane. I remember like a few weeks later, she sent me a picture of Solange Knowles at Paris Fashion Week. Wow, that would have been something else entirely. Fashion Week. That was like, whoa, where did that come from? But yeah, like, she was wearing this big fur, red fur, and she was looked amazing. And like, Elizabeth captioned it like, "Oh, slaying your lane." And I remember just as a joke, like as a pun, and I literally called and was like, "That's the name of the book." So there were lots of like serendipity. Wow. Yeah, like there were loads of weird moments, but that's how it came about. It was crazy.
I love that. And so, okay, let's think about this for our listeners. Like, what's the learning from this? Is it like to I don't know, to collaborate with friends?
Oh, or is absolutely it to like,
yeah,
I'd say there was two. I'd say the first would probably be that collaborate with friends, definitely. Like, I feel like, you know, Elizabeth, because of the kind of person she is, she wanted to like literally gift me this life-changing idea. But I saw something in her that I was like, you would actually make this better. I'm not saying this just because I don't want to like feel bad in 5 years, but honestly, I think you bring something. And she'd only reached out to me because she felt that I brought something too, and that I had like, you know, like an eye, and that I could write well. But also, I'd say that it's also, if you don't see something and you want it to exist, then try to make it if you can, like if you're that way inclined. Because again, Elizabeth had been reading this book and had been like reading lead in and thought, oh, they, you know, I think they had this like supplementary chapter after its release that kind of looked at the Black female experience, but it wasn't enough. And, you know, shout out to Sheryl Sandberg, who like literally messaged us with like, you know, congrats and praise when we released it. Because in we actually, you know, we didn't mince our words, and we did say like, Sheryl Sandberg's amazing, and like Lean In, though it gets a bad rap retrospectively, it was important. It was important at the time. And but we did say like it didn't focus on our experience, and she, you know, very graciously accepted that. And it makes sense she didn't, in a way, because she's not Black. So it's like somebody else did it, and you know, we're very proud of what we did.
And so you came up with this idea, and then I've read that there were 9 publishers fighting for the rights to the book. How did you get from the idea to 9 publishers fighting to give you a 5-book sum?
A lot of Googling. We did not know how to get a book deal. We Googled how to get a book deal, and then it was like, you need to get an agent. And we were like, how do you get an agent? After we found out how to get an agent, or we saw a tweet, actually, it was doing a call out for like, you know, minority writers that were unrepresented and unagented,
right.
And that's literally how we ended up getting there was a lot, again, a lot of serendipity, like a lot. And like like so much Googling. Then it was like, you need to write a proposal. So we were like, okay, how do you write a proposal? And I'm not exaggerating when I say like all of our resources, we did not have a single in, we didn't know anybody, so all of our resources were literally from Google. And then when we got our agent, then she was able to help. But we'd written the proposal before we met her. We had like literally reached out to interviewees, because we'd like slid into the DMs of like, you know, Vanessa Kingori from Vogue, who was then at GQ, and like June Sarpong. We like, I guess like, you know, there's got to be a better way of saying stalked, but essentially stalked her, and you know, found her at the Afro Hair and Beauty Live Show, and you know, asked her then and there if she'd be part of it, and she said yes. So yeah, like there were lots of steps, but like as I said, so much Googling. And when people are like, oh my gosh, like Google is free, like, you know, you'd be shocked at how much you can do with it. I'm like, yeah, because honestly, like we had no one else to help us, so we just had to like, you know, find these like very kindly curated blogs that like would outline the steps to like getting in touch with an agent, and also writing a proposal and stuff. And we've literally just actually recently launched a podcast that looks at the like kind of intricate steps that we took at each stage. But yeah, it was a lot. And the 9-way bidding auction is just in no way what we expected.
I mean, the book is incredible, and it is I mean, it's called The Bible for Black women, and it literally is. Like, how do you feel about it now as an achievement?
I mean, it's amazing. I think that like we really, you know, there was a real gap in the market, and I think that we really wanted to serve it's for Black women by Black women, and we never ever you know, reneged on that. And we're very grateful to For the State, because you know, they allowed us to really properly I guess cater to our market, and really make sure that, you know, we were writing not for the, you know, wider societal gaze, but for the Black female gaze, because that's who we were speaking to. And you know, we were very much just like, we're gonna write this way, and if there are things that people don't understand, again, back to my last point, there's Google, and it costs nothing. And because that's how we've had to ingest media for so long, like we've had to like just, you know, there are loads of things that like don't necessarily speak to me, but I still enjoy them as media. Mm. But they're not written with me in mind, and that's fine. And and that's the thing. I think some people act as if like everything must be written with everyone in mind, and I'm like, no, my ideal actually is rather everybody's allowed to write what they want, and it speaks to whoever, and we're all given the opportunity to be heard. That is much better to me, because like I've always said that like I truly don't believe like 90% of the books that I was reading in school were written with a, you know, young Nigerian British girl from Croydon in mind, but it did not stop me from enjoying them.
What is like the best feedback you've had on the book that really like touched you?
Oh my god, I'm not even being silly when I'm like, there's just too many. I honestly struggle to say, like, you know, one of the like ones that like I would say has probably like made me tear up was reading a black girl that was also at Warwick and also staying in Cryfield, and was saying that she had suffered from mental health stuff when she was at Warwick, and like that reading the chapter on mental health had really sort of helped her through it. And I just thought, oh my god, she's even in the same halls, and I bet you any money it's because it's the bloody cheapest as well, like, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. That was my logic was just like, this is the cheapest hall. But yeah, it just meant a lot. I was like, wow, like I can't believe that, like, you know, someone literally the next generation is literally just like, yeah, this really spoke to me and helped me through uni. And I was like, it honestly, if we'd have just shut it down and helped that one person, like, because I wasn't really sure about talking about my mental health in the book. It's not something I'd ever spoken about publicly before. But then messages like that just make it completely worth it.
You did an amazing thing. You did an amazing thing.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so moment 6 is when you decided to shave your head.
Yes.
What's the significance?
Yes, yes, yes. Do you know what was so funny? Like, honestly, I just wrote about this for the...
I read it. Sunday it's really good.
I was talking about the fact that, like, it's been really did you thank you so much I would honestly say possibly the best picture I have and will ever take in my life. That image is just like,
so
if I
awesome.
Say so myself, like I was just like, a compliment picture, I fucking love it. I was like, yes,
amazing.
This is back to me like being saying that, you know, like again, it's fine for me to say this.
I don't care about,
I mean, looking good is a neutral, exactly, it doesn't mean anything. But yeah, like I shaved my head because like honestly I genuinely was just like, I thought it would suit me. I was interested in what my head shape looked like, which is what one of the people I interviewed said as well for the piece. I was really curious and I just thought, I bet this would look really cute. But like, it was so interesting that when I did it, there was just so much commentary and there was so much, like, it was imbued with so much meaning that like I didn't even necessarily see, like people like, oh, has something happened? Like, you know, there's a thing called the big chop where like when you've had chemicals in your hair, like relaxer or texturizer, a lot of black women are doing this thing called the big chop where they just cut all the like chemicals out of their hair and start again and kind of go fresh. So people like, was this a big chop? But I never, like, most of my life I've like never really had chemicals in my hair anyway. So I was like, definitely not that. My hair was really healthy. I really liked my hair. But I just wanted to see what it looked like. I just felt like, why not? And it's just been the most, like, again, because there is so much history and commentary tied up in hair, it just felt so amazing to just be like, you know what, I've always had like nice big hair and I'm gonna cut it anyway. And like, I know that in the black community that has, like, you know, when you have nice hair in inverted commas, it's meant something you're meant to kind of be a bit like precious about. But I was like, I don't want to be beholden to like looks, and I feel like it kind of comes full circle to the me at 15, me at 27, just being like, I don't want to be beholden to like the fact that like I have and like, you know, a decent amount of hair on my head, so, you know, I should never like let that go. And I was just like, I want to feel like free enough in myself to not care. And also, like, it's been so interesting because whilst on the one hand, like, it doesn't matter at all, on the other hand, it's just been so interesting how differently people treat me. Like, I said this, you mean, you read the piece I was saying that, like, everyone just thinks I'm way more fashionable than I am. And I'm like, I've been wearing the exact same clothes for my entire life.
I really love that point in the piece. I actually written it down in my notes because it's so funny. There are a few things like that, aren't there, in life? Like bright red lipstick, doing up your top button makes you look like you're chic.
Suddenly chic.
You could be wearing anything else and people are like, shoes. It's intentional.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Top button, red lip, the right pair of shoes, having no hair. I'm suddenly like getting DMs from like these fashion brands asking, like, it was crazy. Because I was like, I'm dressing the exact same. I was like, nothing has changed except I don't have hair.
It's so interesting though for like a black woman to do it, because there is so much loaded in hair, right?
Yeah, politically, it's a big conversation. It's a big
conversation. And it's like, you're unburdening yourself. Like, you talk about unburdening. Someone talks about unburdening, don't they, in your piece. Like,
yes.
It's like letting go of like, all of the shit about hair by shaving it off, right? Like all the politics and the practicalities that there are for black women with their hair. And like by shaving it, you're just like, it feels, even though it wasn't for you, like a big like, screw you, I'm not having it anymore.
Exactly. Forget all of that. I know I'll really reach that layer when I stop wearing a bra. That's when I'll be like, you know, those second wave feminists, I mean, they weren't right about everything.
They knew a lot of stuff. My last question to you is a quick one just before we go, because I know you have to go. Which is,
no worries,
thinking about moments in your life, when you need to think about like a pure happy moment, what do you think about? Like if you need to get sleep or something like that, is there a moment you think, oh yeah, that was like
That is such happiness. A good question. Oh my God, that is a really good question. I'm like, what moment would I actually think about? I know it would involve my sisters. That is for sure. I'm like, maybe I can't really pinpoint a moment, because I think I often think of my sisters, like when I'm like stressed, and I just think about like, they just are immediate, like kind of like things that send to me and things, people, human beings that send to me.
Yeah.
But like, I'd say like, maybe even just like, cause when you said that, I was thinking, okay, I know it's my siblings. I know we're young. We just had all these stupid games where it was just like jumping from couch to couch, things like, oh, the floor is lava and stuff. And I just remember that time being so pure and just so fun. And like, my older sister lives in Nigeria now. So it's just very much like, I don't get to see her as much as I'd like to. I do speak to her like pretty much every day, but like, I don't get to see her as much as I'd like to. But like with both of them, like, yeah, so much has changed since. But like, I love to think about like that time when we were just young and stupid.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.